Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
All right, poppers, it's Tuesday, and you know what that means. It's Junk Food Cinema with your resident junkman, Brian Salisbury, and my excellent co-host, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hello.
We've survived South by Southwest, and we're back to bring you the junkiest of the junkie.
It's pretty junky.
It is junky.
Although, not this week.
No, this week is something extra special, but we'll get to that in just a moment. This, of course, is Film School Rejects podcast on cult and genre gems, a show so good, it just has to be bad for you. And I'm excited to announce to everybody that we are now available on something called iTunes.
I've heard of this thing.
Which I feel like the kids are really into right now.
The kids are into the tunes. Everyone's walking around with Zunes right now, and I think iTunes plugs directly into your Zune. I think that's how this works.
Did you just reference Zune? Wow. Bringing it back. Did you read about that on Friendster?
I'm sorry. I thought this was a show where we talked about obscure things from the past that didn't quite hit.
So in addition to iTunes, we're available on MySpace. No, I'm kidding. We are available, however, on Stitcher, which I actually legitimately didn't know what that was until recently. But we are available on both outlets. So if you're not a big fan of iTunes, you can check us out on Stitcher. Just search for Junk Food Cinema in the podcast section. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema, and you can follow the show on the Twitters at Junk Food Cinema. We make it very easy to find us if you know the name of the show.
Yeah.
Which...
Why wouldn't we?
We're not
Let's
hiding.
Let's hide our show.
I've seen
in the deepest,
hiding.
Darkest, dustiest parts of the internets.
I would really appreciate it if we could, you know, if you guys out there... Which, first of all, thank you so much for listening. The show has gotten really good numbers. We appreciate that. I kind of was hoping we would end up on the new and noteworthy section of iTunes, but apparently the Get Smart podcast, like the making of the Get Smart movie podcast, is still in the new and noteworthy section, so... I'm a little dubious of both of those terms when it comes to iTunes, but anyway, I wanted to go ahead and do a shameless plug! Shameless plug!
Wait, we haven't gotten to the shameless plug section yet?
No.
I thought this whole opening has been a shameless plug.
No, we're going to have more plugs than a game show host from the late 80s.
So. Ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba.
Ramp. And this is actually an iTunes review that was left by a listener named Jose Rivera, and I just wanted to read it because it was very, very cool of him to leave this. I've listened to Brian on other podcasts. I've listened to Cargill on other podcasts. And much like Tango and Cash, these two are just as entertaining together as they are separately. Their genuine love for film and the most out there but fun movies is infectious. While only two episodes in, Junk Food Cinema has captured my attention and imagination. I cannot wait to see where they go from here. Thank you so much, Jose. And we will. I've decided I want to read good reviews on the air more often now that we have them.
Well, I, you know, the thing is that's kind of a backhanded compliment. Like, to the people that would listen to this podcast or are listening to this podcast, they get that we would be the Tango and Cash. But yeah. To everyone else, it'd be... Really?
Yeah.
You want to go with that?
Exactly.
Really? Tango and Cash?
Maybe people think,
fuck, yes, we would.
Yeah,
absolutely. Tango and fucking Cash.
Why wouldn't you want to be Tango and or Cash? I am all about that. Absolutely. Well, this week's episode is a very special one because it is an interview episode. Yes, that's right. We actually do those. We're like professionals and whatnot.
Well, in so much as we slip into famous people's hotel rooms and set up a computer and just force them to start talking.
Yeah, it's kind of like a home invasion movie, except all we want is for them to talk about their life. So it's like surprise, this is your life.
It's like, okay, hi, this is Brian. He'll be the guy with the bat today. I'm Cargill. I'm the guy with the battery and the jumper cables. Let's talk about your cinema history.
Well, paraphrasing a popular maxim here, you already know Dick. In this case, I mean Dick Miller. And you heard his voice in our brand spanking new bumper, and I'd bet my last mogwai that you recognize his face, though you may have difficulty kind of combining the two readily. But Dick Miller is one of the hardest working character actors in the business, and why we were so excited to talk to him was that he is a guy whose movies, you know, the movies that he's appeared in have really shaped, you know, at least I, you know, I can speak for myself, and I think I can speak for Cargill as well, have shaped our specific love of movies. Like, those movies are the ones that we go back to time and time again and say, yes, these are the films that, you know, that got us into cult film. These are the films that got us into exploitation movies. These are the gems. And 9 times out of 10, if you're watching one of those gems, it's going to have Dick Miller's name in the credits. And in fact, I get more excited about the movie whenever I see Dick Miller's name in the credits.
Yeah, the thing about Dick Miller is that Dick Miller has actually been there for every major B-movie, underground, independent movement in cinema history since the 50s.
True.
He was there at the dawn of Corman, back when Corman was doing Westerns. I mean, the early Corman days. He was there in the bloody underground horror of the 60s. He was there throughout all the exploitation of the 70s. He was there through, you know, the Young Turks of the 80s and is part of so many of the classic 80s films that we consider the great 80s. He's there in so many of these films. He's even there at the beginning of the indie explosion in the 90s in a famously cut scene. He's in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's been there over the course of his career. He's been right there in independent cinema, always there, always working, always showing up, and always bringing it. And the thing is when he walks on screen, you know you're in for something special, because that's just who he is. And you're probably going to hear us say that a couple times during the interview, because that's really, you know, that is the, it is the quintessence of Dick Miller. That
sure.
He walks into a scene and he owns it. Mm-hmm. And he makes that scene his own, and no one can out-act him in that scene, and no one can steal the scene from him. And he just punctuates that film right then and there, and then we move on into, you know, the rest of that film. And there's so many amazing films in his filmography.
His oeuvre, if you will.
But his filmography, you just go through it and you're like, you've seen, you sitting here, I don't care how many movies you've watched, you've seen probably 20 or 30 movies with Dick Miller in.
He is, you know, as Cargo was mentioning, he's a constant through this thread line of cinema, through all the major upheavals, all the revolutions, all the new generations. The one thing that remains constant in all of these movies, you can trace a direct line from Corman to all of the people that started to, you know, really build up Hollywood in the wake of Corman, and all of those people like Galen Hurd and Joe Dante,
yep,
and all these people who came out of the class of Corman who started to change movies forever, all the way to somebody like Quentin Tarantino, whose entire career is built upon loving and reflecting upon and paying homage to the movies of Dick Miller. So, I mean, he literally is a through line through the history of cinema, and that's one of the reasons we love him, but obviously not the only reason. We were fortunate enough to see That Guy Dick Miller, which is a documentary all about him that played at South by Southwest, directed by Elijah Drinner, who also did American Grindhouse, which I believe right now is streaming on Netflix, so you should definitely check that out. But without further ado, I think it's time for us to play back the tape. This is the last known recording, in fact, of this time that we broke into Dick Miller's hotel room and forced him to tell war stories, essentially.
Yeah.
Well, we are very fortunate to be here. A very rare privilege. I can't even tell you how excited we are to be able to talk to that guy, Dick Miller. The Dick Miller. I'm kind of giddy right now.
I am equally as giddy. I was actually, I thought you had one of your long things prepared, but now I'm seeing how excited you are that you didn't have prepared. Of course, you know Dick Miller, whether the name, you know, sticks right out. The minute you see his face, the minute he walks on screen, a smile comes across your face, because you know you're about to see something great. That every time this guy walks on, he owns the film, and the film becomes about him for that moment. And we have you've seen dozens of his films, mm-hmm, and now we're really excited. Dick, thank you so much for sitting down with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm sitting here with two giddy guys. I don't know what this story is.
We have a lot of stories, but we're more interested, of course, in your stories. And I think we came to know you in movies from the Corman collaborations, from, you know, the, I don't know if we would call them the good old days, but definitely the interesting old days of Corman's productions and how he would work.
They are the good old days.
Yeah. Right?
Practically a step above silent movies. 50 years ago. It's a long time.
Yeah.
So, well, let's begin at the beginning and talk about the early stuff. Because you started out doing Westerns, right?
I started out, you must have heard the story before about how I changed businesses right in the middle of a sentence.
Yeah, you wanted to be a screenwriter.
When I met Roger, a friend of mine brought me up there to see if I could talk maybe a little sales. I was selling scripts, and he said, "Where are you from?" I said, "New York." And "What do you do?" "I'm a writer." He said, "Oh, we don't need writers. We need actors." I said, "I'm an actor." He said, 3 days later, I was in the picture. I was in the movies.
Yeah. You played a cowboy and an Indian in your first week of, working.
Yeah. My first part, isn't that terrible? My first part was an Indian with all kinds of makeup and all kinds of wigs and everything. And when we finished that, which lasted a few days, he says, "You want to play a cowboy for me, a homesteader?" I said, "When is that going?" He says, "Dude, not going, it's tomorrow."
And that's how you found out you were in the same film twice.
I was in it. Played cowboy and an Indian. As a matter of fact, little known, there's a posse. There's a picture. We've already shot the part. The Indians are killed. They shot and they're killed. And he says, "You want to be in the posse?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." And he says, the upshoot was that I wound up shooting myself.
So when it's edited together, you were the cowboy that shot you.
That was it. They had to cut it out.
Oh, that would have been a bit. That Dick Miller shooting Dick Miller.
I'm surprised it got cut out. Like the early days of Corbin, I'm surprised that they were like, "No, we have to remove this."
Cause... Well, they just kind of figured that it might be a little obvious if you see him see the two faces together.
That's outstanding. And then, of course, you know, moving on to, you know, when you were working with Corman and getting leading roles, I know one of my favorites is Bucket of Blood. And what I like particularly about that movie is that correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you're kind of standing in for Corman's overall kind of cynical view of art house coffee shops.
Well, no, Roger, actually, he loved it. From time to time, he did weird things. He went on a trip. He made a picture called A Trip, mm-hmm. and unbeknownst to the public, he got high. And he wanted to see what it was like. Mm-hmm. So this was much earlier than The Trip, but he made a picture, Bucket of Blood, and he thought he was trying to lift up the coffee houses. And I guess maybe he did.
Mm-hmm. He definitely made me want to go and run into characters like Mr. Paisley. So I guess yeah. But in Bucket of Blood, were you doing a lot of the sculpting yourself?
No, we really killed a cat. Of course.
I kind of want to believe that that's the story. Yeah. I really
it was a fake cat. Yeah. And a fake naked girl. And I had to cover her up with clay. And oh, God, it was terrible touching her body and all that.
He says with his wife sitting a few feet away.
No, he's very smart. He's a very smart guy. Absolutely. So, but that's one of those roles that kind of, for a while, people were identifying you with. And I know that you said in the documentary you have several placards in your house with the name of that character.
Walter Paisley.
Yeah.
To tell you what happened, Walter Paisley, I did a picture shortly after that for Joe Dante, and he said, I said, "I noticed here the character, the name was something, I forget what it was." He said, "Why don't we change it and use Walter Paisley?" I said, "We used that name before." He says, "I don't want to do a sequel." He says, "It's not the same character, just the same name. And we'll try it." We did. It worked. The thing was that the third picture and the fourth picture and the fifth picture all were named Walter Paisley, the same character over and over. It's a funny inside joke, but it can go too far.
Do you think it went too far?
Well, I stopped working as Walter Paisley. I don't know.
There's going to be an actor who comes up now whose name is actually Walter Paisley and just continue the lineage on from here.
This is funny. They changed the name. They wanted to call me Walter Paisley in Bury the X. It's a film I just finished.
and you wouldn't let him?
I think we did. I don't know if it was mentioned too much.
So Walter Paisley continues to follow you around to this day?
Yeah, that was just finished.
Wow. Well, I know another movie that we wanted to talk about was Rock All Night.
Yeah.
Which is just a phenomenal film.
Yeah, no, I'm a huge fan of this film, and for those of you out there that haven't seen it, you need to track this movie down. It is what I, for my money, it is the Dick Miller film to end all Dick Miller films. I mean, Dick, you're so amazing in this movie. And it's this really cool kind of fishbowl movie in which there's a bunch of people in a bar when some criminals show up, and Dick Miller plays kind of the angry little guy, rebel without a cause, who just doesn't take crap from anybody.
Anyone.
And it's just so amazing to watch. So you need to track down this movie. But Dick, what do you remember about working on that film and that film in particular?
I forget. No, it was a good picture. I remember that for another reason. I was told to do this part. What's it about? He said, what do you care? You're the lead in it. So it was my first starring role.
Was that Corman saying that?
Yeah.
What do you care? You're the lead. That sounds very Roger.
it worked out fine.
Yeah, no. Was that the movie that your wife saw you in that she remarked?
No. She saw me in War of the Satellites.
War of the Satellites, okay.
Where she made that dirty remark. She made it to a boyfriend, yet he took her to the movies, and she saw me in the movie, and she said, that guy can place his shoes under my bed anytime. And I hope he liked it.
And a love story was born.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's beautiful.
Now you met your wife just a few years after that, right?
Yeah, it took about 2 years for that to come true.
Now that's actually something that was kind of breezed past in the documentary, but I actually wanted to know more about how did you guys actually meet? What was the
about Schwab's drugstore? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which is no longer there, unfortunately. It's just the, I don't know, they turned it into something else. But in those days, it was Schwab's. It was a beautiful place, drugstore. Everybody hung out, actors and gangsters and everybody. She was in there with another actor, and I, who was a friend of mine. And he introduced us. And I think from that moment, from the moment we were introduced, I guess I had a feeling about this girl, because we never separated since then.
Which is awesome, yeah. And we're both two happily married men that are big fans of that kind of stuff. So yeah. That was one of the things we talked about. It's like, it's so cool, LA people who have been married for 50 some odd 60 yeah. years.
You don't see that too often in show business.
It's really especially in Hollywood.
Yeah.
There is just oh, you married 3 years, good.
And how many years have you guys been together now?
55.
That's outstanding.
Yeah.
Nice.
55 years. And it really is really unbroken.
That's wonderful. Yeah, like we were saying, that's just not something you hear about in Hollywood too often. And it was one of the things that was really touching about the documentary is how much interplay there was between the two of you, and then seeing you both at the screening. It was just, it was very uplifting. I found that very sweet. I don't know, maybe I'm a softy. I might be a softy.
We're both, yeah. We're both ridiculous. So what are you gonna do?
Gee, these giddy guys are terrible.
We're sorry. No, so
can't help it.
So from that point, like that was the interesting thing about watching the documentary, in that there seemed to be, you know, like two different Dick Millers. There's the early Dick Miller when you were a young single guy in Hollywood, and then the moment you got married and kind of moved on into this next movement of your life, where there just seemed to be a different kind of spark, and like there's almost like a line of demarcation there.
I don't know, the spark, it's not different really. My nature didn't change. My outlets for my nature changed. I think before, I'm a happily married man. I'm a happily married man, yeah. Before I met Lainey, I guess I was pretty wild. But there's a little difference in our age. I don't know if you know about that. She's a child bride.
Wasn't that one of Corman's movies at one point?
If it wasn't, it should have been.
And I'm like 12 years older than her. So it was easy to con a young girl.
That's too funny. But it does seem like that becomes the point where you started playing a lot of, you know, I think even the documentary referred to it as these blue collar characters, and you turn up in these roles where it's like you're playing police officers, you're playing guys that are, you know, working desks and you know, really kind of salt of the earth characters, whereas like Walter Paisley and your character from Rock All Night are you know, kind of extreme examples of humanity. You know, suddenly you're playing more salt of the earth type characters, which has always been, I think, a trademark that people have latched onto with your work.
Well, as an actor, you take anything.
Sure.
And has nothing to do with you, with your nature, your personal nature. I could have been the most ferocious, tempered person in the world and be playing the most gentlest. I did play a priest, I remember.
Remember? He was a pedophile.
What?
He was a pedophile.
Oh, yes, he was a... He was a pedophile priest.
And which film is this?
What was that? I can't remember the picture. But the guy had won an Oscar for the German actor. He was quite good. What was it?
Is that the only time you played a priest? Is they give you the priest pedophile role the one time you play a priest?
I wanted to play a rabbi, but they wouldn't have me.
So, do you know, you played cops a lot. Do you know how many times you might have done that, or was it just all really blur together?
You got a little notebook and then I say, oh, play cop number four, play cop number five. It doesn't happen. I don't even remember that. I remember I played a couple of uniformed policemen. Then I played Big Bed Mama, was that it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I played a detective.
And then one of Brian's favorite films, Night of the Creeps.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Night of the Creeps is a film I revisit a lot.
Yes, yeah. That's a big... Now I forget that so many pictures you do play officers in. There was a time where I started putting on weight, and I saw myself playing either truck drivers or night watchmen for the rest of my career. And I was maybe about 40 years old at the time. And I thought, this is it. This is the end of it. I'm gonna be playing night watchman from here on in. But I lost weight, got the part I wanted, whatever that was.
But for a while, you were afraid that you were going to be a night watch. You were going to be the night watchman of cinema. You would just be, every time there was a night watchman character, it would be Dick Miller.
Pretty much, if you were lucky. I really figured that by that time you were. Career is going to end. Mm-hmm. Most actors, they don't go much further than 10 years. That's a long time. Yeah. 15 years, if they're lucky.
Well, that's what's been so amazing about watching your career is you've really stood the test of time and been there from, you know, from the dawn of modern cinema and all the way through, and worked with so many of the greats. And you can draw a line of cinema through your career. And
oh, God, how wonderful.
Yeah, you really... Who has been, you know, among all of the, you know, the myriad amazing actors that you've worked with, Like, do you remember who has, you know, who left a special mark on you as you moved through?
I've met the giants. I've said this before. I've met the giants of the industry. I met the Gagneys and the Gables and the Karloffs and everything. And each one, there's not much more than that. It was the meeting. It was the kind of thing that stays with you. Mm-hmm. Cagney, for instance, was doing Man of a Thousand Faces. A friend of mine wrote the picture, and he says, "You want to see Cagney work?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I'd love to. Come on out to the studio." I got out there, and he was doing a scene where he was about 15 to 20 feet from the set. He was sitting in a chair. We met him. He talked to each other. He says, "I got to go now." They call somebody. He says, "Cagney." He says, and he got up and he danced the 20 feet to the set. I was amazed.
Wow. So one of the movies that I really wanted to talk about was Piranha, which was a film that, you know, Jaws was a movie that, like, my grandfather introduced me to, and it was like a bonding experience in our family. So when I saw Piranha for the first time, and I lovingly noticed, like, all of these little sort of inside jokes about Jaws. And one of the best inside jokes in Piranha is the fact that they have the sort of mayor-type character who's ignoring the threat until it's too late. And in the case of Piranha, that character was played by you.
The same... I hate to think it was stolen.
No. It was lovingly homaged.
Okay. We buy that.
So what do you remember about working on
I don't know. I just remember one scene that was funny. We were talking to a crowd of people. I was on a microphone, I think, I was on stage, and I was making a speech to this crowd of people. And I said... I really hope that my accent carries through, and you don't give it too much away that I'm New York. In fact, we did a thing to cover it. I'll tell you about that. But I'm giving it cowboy talk, I think, and I'm wailing away, and the audience were all these college kids from the university here. They were all extras, and I finished the whole thing, and... The one guy in the front, he says, "You're not from here." I thought, "Oh, shit."
I have been found out.
He says, "You're not from here." I said, "Yeah, where am I from?" He says, "You're from Dallas. I can tell."
Well, there is a little Dallas section of New York, if I remember correctly.
Houston Street, I think it's called.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
So what did you do to cover it up?
Yeah.
Later on, I figured, I said, why doesn't this character, when he's in New Jersey, talk like a New Jersey guy? When he's in California, talk like a Californian guy? He becomes a hometown man, and he's really not from Austin. He's not from Texas at all. They said, "How are you going to do that?" I said, "I'll do that." I got on the phone and I have a conversation with a guy where I completely slip into New York mode. And I finish up, I call him Schmuck, and I hang up. So that was it. They bought it.
No, I know what scene you're talking about. That scene really, really works.
Yeah.
And it's that film in particular, it's one of those films that really highlights how good you are at comedy by just playing the straight man.
Yeah.
And that scene in particular is one of them that really works. That, and of course we were talking about the scene this morning, the classic one where, you know, what about the piranhas?
They're eating the guests. I love that. I love that line. When you are so engaged in what you're doing, and your assistant's just like, "It's about the piranha." You're just like, "What about the damn piranha?" Well, they're eating the guests, and the look on your face when he says that, it's classic. So, yeah.
Yes, I was meant for movie pictures.
You were.
You were definitely meant for movie pictures.
No, it's one of the things I really, I think the documentary really gets across is, I mean, you really are one of those actors that when you walk into a scene, you know, the scene just changes. It becomes about your character, and you're always interesting. And I can't recall a single movie in which you walk on to the set and somebody else takes that scene from you, or I mean, the classic one, in Terminator, where Arnold Schwarzenegger is there, he's the Terminator. The movie is about him. It's called The Terminator. The minute he walks into the gun shop scene, I remember the first time I saw that movie, and that gun shop scene just really stuck with me as what that movie was. And you have this power about you to be able to just steal from everybody, even someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Is there any kind of trick that you've done to master that, or is it really just your charisma overwhelms?
Well, I'd like to think it was just my charisma, and so I will.
Okay, we'll buy that. That is an acceptable answer.
This is why he just summed up why every time he's on scene, you can't help but focus on him. So I will. So you worked with Dante again, obviously, on Gremlins, and I think Murray Futterman is another one of those characters that kind of is a great insight into the kind of characters that you play. And if we were to try to introduce people to your work, I mean, Gremlins, Murray Futterman would be like near the top of the list of like, okay, you need to watch Dick Miller in this movie to understand just how great he is. So what do you remember about working on Gremlins with Joe?
I can't think of anything that went wrong, went right.
how did you meet Joe Dante? How did that? Because you guys have worked together a lot.
Yeah, we met on Hollywood Bullocks. Thank you. I didn't know that he was getting up a deal with Roger, where he would use clips from other pictures. Mm-hmm. And he could see, I don't know if there was a bet or not, but he said, I can make this picture for nothing. If I only had the clips, how can you use all these clips? Killings in the Philippines, motorcycle races, all kinds of ridiculous things that had no bearing on each other. And he put together this wonderful little picture called Hollywood Boulevard. And I got on, and I didn't know that they kind of admired my work, I guess. And that's how I got the part. I just met him.
Yeah, because Joe was cutting trailers with Alan R. Cush for Corman. So that was kind of, I guess that movie was kind of the ultimate celebration of what Joe had been doing for Corman, because it's just like, take those trailers and make a movie out of it. So that's where you guys first crossed paths, was on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, so it was a good meeting.
And you've done, gosh, I'm trying to remember, like, it's been at least 10 movies with Joe now, right?
I don't know if it's that much. Gee, it could be.
It's
that is, right? Wow.
In The Howling, when you have the bookstore, one of the things that the documentary actually brought to light was that was a reference to one of your really early pictures with Corman, Not of This Earth. Where you're a vacuum cleaner salesman.
Oh, yeah.
And you have that line where you're like, poiches, poiches, poiches. And then in the bookstore, that bookstore owner says it again.
I didn't realize it until you mentioned when I saw it the other night. And I just said, that's pretty funny. I use that line again.
It's just so, trademark New York, which is obviously you're from New York. That's a big part of who you are and what you bring to these characters. And I just thought it was a great little callback to, an earlier moment in your career. Just poiches, poiches, poiches.
One of the other things we wanted to talk about, Brian and I are part of this group here in Austin. We get together in the middle of the night at, we're all writers, and we get together in the middle of the night at this coffee shop. And it's this coffee shop, Jim's, where at any given time you can walk in and one of the other guys is probably there, or you'll be sitting having, coffee in the middle of the night, and they'll show up and we'll sit around, we'll talk movies and such. And you had a similar thing during, the mornings when you guys weren't working. With Robert Forster, who's one of our absolute favorites.
And Robbie Forster's a good buddy of mine, and it's funny that he got in a Quentin Tarantino.
Well, you both did.
Well, yeah, but he's stayed on.
Well, we were talking about that because That's a really common thing for Quentin's films, is he'll have these really great, amazing actors do these great scenes, and then the scenes will end up on the cutting room floor, and you have to watch the DVD. We were talking about Kill Bill. It happened to Michael Jai White. It seems like almost every film that he shoots, he cuts someone out. And then it shows up. I don't know if you know, but it's on the DVD.
I know about that, which I was sort of a pacifier. When I got over the heat, anger, and I let him know, he says, you're out of the picture, but you on the DVD, you're on the end. I put it back in, and I said, that's kind of nice.
And it's for those of you that aren't familiar with what we're talking about, there's a scene in which Dick plays Monster Joe, the place where they take the bodies. And it's a great scene where Monster Joe and the wolf are kind of joking back and forth because they clearly do this.
And I just love watching two, you know, fantastic New York guys, just the repartee between you and Keitel in that scene. Frankly, I want to see an entire movie about Monster Joe, and I want to know where I can sign up to make that film, just an entire movie about Monster Joe, because that was a really captivating scene. I'm really disappointed that it got cut.
It was a little sequel to it, the short that I just made in New York. What was that?
Cutaway,
it's called.
With you and Abe Vigoda.
Yeah, and do you remember the girl's name?
Charlotte Rampling.
Yeah. That, oh, wonderful. I got it right. I've yet to see it. I don't know what it's all about, but it the idea that it's a continuation of guys who gets cut out of pictures, and
famously cut out of pictures.
Yeah.
Because Vigoda was in the conversation and got cut out of that. Have you seen the Abe Vigoda website that somebody's been running for years?
No.
It's called isabevigodastillalive.com. And you go to the website, and it's a picture of Abe Vigoda, and it says, yes, Abe Vigoda's still alive.
Well, if you saw him, he doesn't seem like it.
Well, definitely, I don't want to have this opportunity and not talk about Demon Knight, which is another one of those, like... There is a perception that once you get into the 90s that a lot of the genre fare starts to kind of fall off a little bit. Like, it's not quite as high quality. But I always, when I hear that argument, I always immediately go to films like Demon Knight, you know, the Tales from the Crypt movie, and say, no, genre was actually very much alive in the 90s. And in fact, it was relying upon, you know, the great mainstays, and you were definitely one of them. I mean, what do you remember about working on Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight?
Just that I kind of consider it my favorite film.
Yeah.
I don't take it with the hundreds of films I've done, I don't take one picture over another. There are parts I enjoyed, like, you know, in The Terminator, etc. But there are, it really, I don't know.
I just remember Uncle Willie in Demon Knight being... another of those, just like, it's something about you as a performer that every time you're on screen, you're an extremely likable guy, even when Uncle Willie is, you know, even when he turns, it's like, well, it's still Uncle Willie. I don't want Uncle Willie to get hurt, even though he's now demonized.
Yeah, well, I liked it because of the makeup and all the things like that, and my head rolling around on the floor and things. I guess that's why it's my favorite.
Because it gave you the most satisfactory death scene.
Yeah.
Do you remember, I guess you have been killed off in a lot of movies in a lot of unceremonious ways.
I would say 50% of my films I've died in them.
Why haven't we seen them on Game of Thrones yet?
I don't know. I really don't. That is something we need to make happen immediately. But yeah, Demonite, Gremlins, Piranha, man, there's so many great films in your catalog that have become, and it's also one of those things that we'll just be watching a movie, you know, we're just like, I've never heard of this film, I'll put it on, and if I see the name Dick Miller in the cast, then I'm like, okay, now I'm excited for this movie that I haven't seen before. So you definitely have that power, like just seeing your name in the cast list, like, and it totally changes my expectation for the movie. I get very excited for it.
It's good to hear that. It really. Really is.
And we're definitely not alone on that. I mean, have you been surprised by, I mean, you definitely have a cult following.
Over the years, I even now, it's 60 years later, I'm still wondering, where is this following come from? I've been in theaters, I've seen my show, and I'll tell you what, I was doing a pilot for a film, and when they mentioned my name, just the cast list, to the audience, they broke out in applause. And I said, who the hell's that for? This is for you. And that is the attitude that amazes me. I'll be in the theater, and I'll come on, as you say, see me the first time, somebody will get let out of hoop.
Yeah.
Attaboy.
I think you're the guy that epitomizes the, you know, no small parts. I mean, you make it impossible to write a small part, because any small part that somebody does write for you, you just, you know, you turn into something fantastic. And you're the guy that kind of negates the idea that there ever is anything like a small part. So
yeah. Only short actors.
So do you have a film that you particularly love that nobody ever mentions, that nobody ever talks about, that you wish more people would see or revisit?
That's a good question. I don't have an answer.
Okay.
There's nothing. Every picture is about the same. As easy as there's no small parts, only small actors. It seems like holding on to one out of hundreds is a little difficult. No picture has impressed me that much.
Well, we really want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us. This is such a treat for us, and you have your films have meant so much to the way that we have, you know, our specific movie tastes have been shaped by various films that you've appeared in. So we want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
That's okay. It's a pleasure, really, being here with you two giddy guys. Watching you laugh and the effect it has on your bodies and your hair. Look at that, standing straight up. It's amazing.
That is the power of Dick Miller.
Indeed.
Thank you.
So that is Dick Miller. Like, I'm still a little giddy.
We're the two giddy guys.
We are the two giddy guys, absolutely. I was so proud that we earned a moniker from Dick Miller.
I'm so glad that we held it together as well as we could. I mean, there's, it's one of those things, and it's a weird thing that when you work in film journalism or when you work in the film industry, you get pretty inured to, you know, celebrity.
Sure.
And you can sit in a room with somebody who's really famous, and they're just a person. You can see them as just a person. And then there's those rare times where you meet somebody who just tickles everything about your love of film so much in a way. And it's always the oddest people. Like, it's never been – I've never been starstruck when I've met, you know, an A-list celebrity. It's always when I meet someone that – to me, was an A-list celebrity. And that was someone like Dick Miller.
Yeah.
You know, I remember the first time it happened when I was a kid, it was Michael Landon, who just, you know, if you ever had a chance to meet Michael Landon, you know he was one of those guys who had genuine charisma just oozing out of every molecule. And just everyone around him loved him, and he kind of had this glow. And he did that to me. And then, you know, there's a handful of people over the years that I've met that I was like, and Dick Miller was one of those.
Yeah, I remember going into cold sweats when I met Roger Corman. Oh, and it looks like we have now officially said his name enough that the Corman alarm has gone off. That was the Corman alarm. But yeah, when I met Roger Corman, I was like literally like shaking. Like, it's one of those things. I've been doing it for a while. Sort of the aura of celebrity had celebrity had been demystified in a lot of ways with anybody else, but this guy just meant so much to me. And then meeting Dick Miller was sort of like a happy compendium to that. And you're right. I'm glad we were able to hold it together even as giddy as we got. I'm really happy that we didn't just collapse on the floor and start drooling all over ourselves.
And what a nice guy.
Such a nice guy.
It's another one of those things that the people who tend to play assholes on film tend to be the nicest people in the world. And man, was he cool.
Absolutely. Well, wrapping up this episode, we want to throw out to you. We mentioned, if you listened to the entire interview or if you jumped around a little bit, we're going to help you out because we're going to give you the five quintessential Dick Miller roles, the five quintessential Dick Miller movies that you need to seek out and watch now that you have heard the man talk, the man himself, you have heard him from on high. Here are the movies that you need to now go out and watch. And Cargo, what is the first movie on that list?
Well, that's Rock All Night.
Of course it's Rock All Night. It's probably – I go back and forth between Rock All Night and Bucket of Blood, but man, Rock All Night is such an incredible performance. I mean, it is one of the few times that Dick Miller gets to headline a movie, gets to be the star of a film. And he had absolutely that star power. He had that charisma. But he just, you know, he was one of those guys that often found himself in smaller roles. But, you know, as we mentioned during the interview, he's the guy that epitomizes there are no small roles.
There are no small roles. No. So the second film on the list would be?
Oh, Bucket of Blood, in fact. Walter Paisley was a role that so encapsulated Dick Miller that it's a name that's followed him around, as we mentioned in the interview. He has been called Walter Paisley in a number of subsequent films and has placards all over his house with the name Walter Paisley. It's become inextricable from Dick Miller. You see Dick Miller sometimes, if you can't remember the name Dick Miller, you just know him as Walter Paisley.
And I'll go with number three. How about Gremlins?
Oh, of course.
Gremlins is – and that's another one. That's probably his most mainstream role.
Sure.
And that's the one that is most readily accessible in terms of as Mr. Futterman.
Murray Futterman.
And it's one of his more endearing roles.
Absolutely.
Where you actually really kind of feel for this guy, as racist though he may be.
Yeah. He wants American-made cars, damn it. That's his biggest
flaw. He's the lovable racist. He's just a little bitter. And Gremlins is one of those movies that has that kind of cool nostalgia factor, but at the same time, 30 years removed, it's like, wow, those guys in World War II really still were carrying around a little bitterness.
WWII. Yeah, I mean, Gremlins, he was so good in Gremlins that they gave him a bigger part in Gremlins 2, for God's sake. Come on. The only other character that had a bigger part in Gremlins 2 is the talking gremlin, so there you have it. Also, Demon Knight, which,
course.
First of all, if you haven't seen Demon Knight, go track that down immediately. Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight was a movie that I remember in my youth seeing at the video store and the poster scaring the shit out of me. So when I finally did muster up the courage to watch it, what an incredibly fun film. I really dig the hell out of that. And he's exactly in that movie the way that we muse about him, like the lovable Dick Miller, the lovable Uncle what is his name in that movie?
Uncle Willie?
Uncle Willie. Yeah, he's the lovable Uncle Willie.
That's one of his favorite roles, and he really enjoyed making that film. So that's – and it really shows.
Definitely.
I mean, that really – and that was kind of his last big role. And then, of course, the fifth film, the one that you and I did a watch a movie with us, Piranha. He's not a huge role, but he – man, does he own that as kind of the villain of that movie.
And not one to shy away from another shameless plug. Cargill is referring to watch a movie with us on oneofus.net, which is my other website. So don't tell Neil that I mentioned that. And Piranha, I love that, it's a Jaws knockoff, and he is the mayor character. He is the guy that refuses to acknowledge the man-eating threat until it's too late. What about the damn piranha? They're eating the guests. Absolutely. So those are the five Dick Miller movies that you need to track down and watch. We hope you've enjoyed this time that we just get to sit and listen to the tales of the good old days, the all or nothing days from the man himself, Dick Miller. I know we were over the moon for it. So
yeah.
All right. Well,
that's junk food cinema.
That's gonna wrap up this week's junk food cinema. It's gonna wrap it up in foil and stuff it in a bag and big old greasy tasty bag. I want to remind you once again, you can find us on iTunes and on Stitcher. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Or you can find us individually on Twitter. I'm at Bry Guy Salisbury.
I'm at Massive Worm.
At Massive Worm.
No, Massawyrm.
Massawyrm.
M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M. You know that.
I know. I just
why are you don't do that. You're gonna people are gonna be like, Massive, I don't understand.
Oh no, now you won't have any Twitter followers.
I have no Twitter followers.
Oh, fuck you. Thanks for listening, guys. Please, if you do like us, go on to iTunes and leave a 5-star rating and review, why not? We really appreciate it. But for now, we're gonna sign off because there are more Dick Miller movies to watch.
There really are.